sound political business, of course. Theodore could not be allowed to go free and unpunished. The country wouldn't stand for it. On the other hand, he'd be a most embarrassing prisoner to call to account. Much better for all concerned if he simply left the scene. And who better to shove him off the tail of the cart than good old Flashy, favourite ruffian of the Foreign Office, Palmerston recommended, practically by appointment, assassin extraordinary to Her Majesty. Demises discreetly arranged, moderate terms. If I were a sensitive man, and not a little flattered to be regarded as the most fatal nemesis since Jack Ketch, I might easily be offended. 'Twasn't the first time. I'd been sicked on to murder poor old John Brown in 59, as you know, but shirked, so the Yankees had to do it themselves, to the disgust of the world, and serve 'em right. In the meantime, having finished listening to his own letter and nodded approval, Theodore had to endure another bout of impassioned whispering from Al-Ami, who was terrified that the letter would bring down Napier's wrath on everyone's head. Prideaux explained to me that our people, Speedy especially, had left Al-Ami in no doubt of what would happen if the war went on, and scared him to death by having Penn show him our guns and rockets. Speedy had also hinted that if Al-Ami and the other chiefs didn't restrain Theodore, it would be the worse for them. But whatever warnings Al-Ami was pouring into the royal ear seemed to be having no effect. He was told to hold his tongue. Prideaux and Flad were sped on their way with the letter, and when Prideaux asked for a drink of water before setting off, he was told peremptorily that there wasn't time. I couldn't guess what Napier would make of the lunatic message, but one thing was sure. He daren't take action that might risk the prisoners. There was no knowing what Theodore was liable to do. At the moment of dispatching the letter, he was ready for a fight, and so were his followers. But within an hour, he seemed to be thinking better of it. He called a council of his chiefs, insisting that I and his German artisans attend, and even placed me on a stool beside his seat of state. Then, with his chiefs ranged in a semicircle before him, a dozen black villains with their spears and swords across their knees looking daggers at me in the square heads, he began to shout abuse at them, much in the style of his letter to Napier. They had betrayed him when his back was turned. They were sheep when he wasn't on hand to inspire them. They were a heathen generation, whom he had nourished and sheltered in a heathen land. But now he was here to lead and inspire, and out of the evil that he had done, good would surely come. So let them speak. What was to be done? They were in no doubt. I can see them now, the dark faces with their teeth bared, the clenched fists thumping their knees as one after another voted to kill the prisoners and fight to the death. Ras Angada, the chief minister, even hinted that Theodore had been too soft altogether. The prisoners should be herded into a hut and burned alive if Napier attacked. This was received with acclamation by all but two, Al-Ami and another, and I feared the worst until I noticed that Theodore was looking sourer with each successive vote for the war party. And all of a sudden, he exploded.
Are you blind that you cannot see the English want only their prisoners? Let them go, and we shall have peace. But if they are hurt, not one of us will be left alive. You urge me to war, and reproach me for weakness. So kill me if you will, but do not revile me.
He was fairly foaming, driving his spear into the carpet again, and they piled out in haste, all but Ras Engada and Al-Ami, and another whom he sent post-haste to bring the prisoners down from Magdala. Then he calmed down and gave me the sanest, happiest smile.
"Be of good cheer, my best of friends," says he, and to the Germans, "and you also, good friends and servants who have worked so well for me. Soon you will be with your rescuers."
Which cheered them up no end, and they went out blessing him and tugging their forelocks. And they were no sooner through the fly than he snatched a pistol from his belt, shoved it between his teeth, and squeezed the trigger. And it misfired. But he was a trier, the same Theodore. Before I'd time to think, "That's your sort, old man," he'd thump back the second hammer, and if Engada hadn't made a flying dive, the interfering ass, and knocked the piece from his hand, the pavilion canopy would have needed laundering, for this barrel went off splendidly and blew a hole in the tent pole. After which Theodore groaned, sighed, drew his shammer over his face, lay down, and went to sleep. I, out of sheer curiosity, picked up the pistol and took the cap from the barrel that had misfired. It looked sound, so I tapped it smartly with the pistol butt, and it cracked with a puff of smoke. Why it had misfired, heaven knows. Perhaps there's a fate that looks after mad monarchs. Dr. Blanc told me later that when they received the summons to go down to the